Welcome to The Partial Historians.
We explore all the details of ancient Rome.
Everything from political scandals to love affairs, the battles waged, and when citizens turn against each other. I'm Dr. Rad.
And I'm Dr. G. We consider Rome as the Romans saw it by reading different ancient authors and comparing their accounts.
Join us as we trace the journey of Rome from the founding of the city.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your hosts. I am Dr. G.
And I am your other host, Dr. Rad.
Hello, Dr. Rad.
Hello, Dr. G. It's so nice to have you back from Italy. Well, for me.
It is a pleasure to be back. I'll admit I regretted it for a little while, but today is very sunny and warm and feels kind of Romanesque. So I'm back on board with being in Australia.
It is getting very hot in here.
Maybe too hot too soon.
Yeah, it's a worrying sign. But nonetheless, this is going to cool down a bit later this week, so I can return to my wintry state.
Your natural habitat, as it were.
Exactly, yes.
So we are tracing the history of Rome from the founding of the city. Yeah. And if you are interested in supporting our work, we have a Patreon. We also do some merch. And we've also just released our book on the Roman kings. So there's plenty of ways when you miss us between episodes to feel like you have us close at heart.
Indeed. And you can pick up our book online in a digital version from Gumroad or from Amazon. Or you can pick it up in a physical form from Abbey's bookstore in Sydney.
Yeah, we are very lucky to have it stocked in our hometown. So we're thrilled about that. And so in the grand tradition of where we're up to in this narrative history, I think we should start with a bit of a recap of what might have been happening up till now.
Yes. Well, last episode we were talking about the years 417 and 416, and they were a bit blurred together as far as I could see. Couldn't really separate them out. But what I could tell was that there was some classic conflict of the orders happening.
Oh boy, it's the subject that just keeps on giving.
It certainly does. And so last episode we were dealing with the fact that some of the tribunes of the plebs were trying to pass a law about land, which is an ongoing concern, obviously, for the plebeian class. And in order to foil them, the patricians came up with an evil plan.
Classic times. I mean, the minute you ask for agrarian reform, I think you're also at the same time asking for patrician evil plans. That's kind of, these two things go naturally together for the elite in Rome.
They certainly do. And so we had one of the Appii Claudii people, the Appius Claudiuses of the world, coming along with a douchebag plan of turning tribunes against each other, which of course worked.
Damn it.
I know. And so that's kind of what we were dealing with last episode, Dr. G.
All right. Now, I suspect that you will have lots of things to tell me about the things that are coming up.
Lots is a relative term.
All right. Okay. Well, that's good to know because I'm still sort of swimming about sort of without a real proper narrative source to hold on to. So I'm always cobbling together little bits and pieces from all sorts of source material and hoping that I have a hint of something that might have happened.
I know. I'm picturing you very much as being like adrift in an ocean, just like paddling about like doggy paddle style, grabbing at pieces of wood that are just like floating there, just like at the end of Titanic.
I always hope as a dog in the ocean that I'll find a big stick, but you know, sometimes I have more, sometimes I have less.
I'll take you any which way, Dr. G.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Ah.
415 BCE.
Don't you mean 414 BCE?
No, I mean 415 BCE.
Oh, let me scroll up. No wonder I don't know what's going on.
I'm quite definite on that.
Fair enough. It's 415 BCE.
It certainly is, Dr. G. And I'm gallantly allowing you to once again tell me about the magistrates.
Thank you. I have so little to say otherwise, so I really appreciate this generosity.
Absolutely.
This is a year where we have military tribunes with consular power. And there's a whole bunch of them.
There are. There is. I don't know. There was.
They're all patricians, so let's get the big stuff out of the way first. We have Publius Cornelius Cossus. We have one Gaius Valerius Volusi Potitus Volusus.
I feel like that's a bit repetitive, but sure.
He's got a lot of names.
He does.
This will be the start of an illustrious career, so keep your eye on this guy. We have somebody who we're not really sure about the praenomen of. It's either Numerius or Marcus as the praenomen. Fabius Vibulanus.
Okay.
And just to sort of cement the confusion around this guy, Broughton thinks that this might have also been the guy that was consul in 421. Now, that guy had a praenomen possibly of Gnaeus. So that leaves us with like three possible praenomens. So we really have no idea which dude this is. It's one of the Fabii Vibulani.
I was going to say, he's a fabulous Fabian, and that's all we need to know.
He's fabulous, and we continue onwards and hope for the best.
Exactly.
And we also have Quintius Cincinnatus. Now, this sounds like a very familiar dude, but actually we haven't seen this guy before.
No, but he must be from that family.
Very illustrious, very esteemed.
Well, all of these names are actually pretty illustrious, aren't they? We've got the Cornelii, the Valerii, the Fabii.
Yeah, these are all families, all patrician families that have been swirling around in positions of power before. So we've definitely seen all of these families. Nobody here is like a fresh novice homo, as it were, into power.
What'd you call me?
nothing. You've been here the whole time. I also have the name of a tribune of the plebs.
Oh, yes.
One Lucius Decius. Luke 10.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he a 10 out of 10?
You and I are making the same jokes now.
Two in sync. We got to slow down.
That's it. This podcast is over.
That's right. Yeah. When we start making the same jokes, it's time to move on.
So I'll have some things to say about Lucius Decius, I think, at some point. But okay. I think maybe the narrative should unfold a little bit before I go into that kind of bit of detail.
Okay, fair enough.
I hand it over duly to you.
Well, thank you. Let me tell you what Livy says about this year. I mean, this is going to excite you, so be prepared. Rome would have been facing two wars in this year. Now, you'd notice I said would have been.
Livy, what are you doing?
Yeah, and that's because they are both postponed.
Oh.
I know.
I couldn't possibly make that time. Somebody send for the army in 3 months. That's when I'll be next available.
Exactly. I've accidentally double booked myself. I can't possibly go to war with Rome right now.
I have a tea party. Don't you understand?
I've got to have my hair done. It takes a while.
What do you mean they've been postponed, Livy?
Well, get ready for the enthralling account of how these wars were postponed. I'm late for a very important date.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yes. Okay. So one of the first conflicts was with Vey. I actually feel like we haven't mentioned Vey in a little while.
They've been a bit quiet, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, there was a bit of conflict going on there for a while, but here they are back again. Anyway, so the first conflict was meant to be with Vey. Now, allegedly, the leaders of Vey got spooked about going to war because the Tiber had flooded, ruining some of their farms and farmhouses. And if you're about to get all geographical on me, just wait, because I will come back to that.
wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah. You're right if you're thinking that there is a problem. Now, I'm not geographically minded, so I probably would not have noticed this, but this is where geographers come in and save the day. But I'll come back to that in a second. The other one was with the Aquians. Now,
Okay.
They were put off after having been defeated when they had allied with a group called the Balani. Now, the Balani sound like a delicious sandwich meat.
What are you having? I'm having the Balani. What about you?
Exactly, yeah. Now, it seems that the Balani were a tribe that lived within this wider Aquian group. So that's why the other Aquians were helping them out. And Balani had been one of the groups that had been attacking the territory of the Labici and the new settlers at Labici. Yes.
I might have something to add to that.
Okay. Well, I'll finish my little story about them and then you can add your thing. Balani had been hoping that they were able to get away with attacking Labici by getting all the Aquians together to support them in this quest. But they didn't get the backup that they were hoping for, ended up losing their town and all their lands after a siege and a battle, and I quote my translator of Livy, in a war which does not even merit description.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm presuming that this means that this is a war that we haven't heard about, but
I'm willing to talk about this war, but I'm not willing to describe it. It happened. We're moving on.
Exactly. Let's just put it behind us, all right?
Look, I appreciate that, and I wish that happened more with military history. I mean, the details are always baffling. Somebody ran down a hill. Somebody else was hiding behind a tree.
Yes.
Outrageous.
So some cavalry was, you know, secreted behind some bushes.
That's right. You know, somebody jumped out of a cave.
Took me by surprise.
Goodness me. All right. So I think Balani, the Balani people that you're talking about, are probably the inhabitants of Bola or Bole.
Yes. Yes, they are. Yes, I can confirm that.
Okay. So this is the ancient city in Latium that is, we think we know the position of it. So I'm getting sort of geographical again. Southeast of Rome.
Right.
But even further east than the Castelli Romani region. So okay. Those mountains, there's not that many of them. They kind of stick out of the ground in an odd spot because they're volcanic in nature.
Okay.
But once you get around those and, like, you know, the magma stops spitting out and stuff, then you go back into, like, you know, plains and valleys.
Mm.
And Bola is supposed to be over in that direction. So it's near the ancient city of Labicum.
Okay.
So the Labici and the Balani would know each other probably quite well. They're neighbours.
It makes sense why the people from Balani were trying to steal from the Labici then. Who, by the way, I'm just going to say for any other people who are watching Drag Race out there, I can't say this now without thinking of the Australian drag queen, Gabriella Labucci. This must be where she's from.
There's a nice synergy there.
Yeah.
And the other little tidbit of detail that I have about Bola as a place is that it is thought to have been founded by the king of Alba Longa.
Ooh.
So this is a little detail that comes through in Virgil's Aeneid.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
This is, I think, another reason why it comes up. So not only does this situation with the Aquians mean that there is no war with the Aquians in this year, this is where our Tribune of the Plebs comes in. One Lucius Decius, as you said, he is trying to pass a law in which colonists would be sent to Bole as well as Labici. But his fellow tribunes stop him from doing this and would not allow a plebiscite without the Senate saying it was okay with this idea.
What?
Cricket sound effect here.
Yeah, I mean, you've caught me speechless.
I know.
So they want agrarian reform in the form of colonization. So putting people out there, giving them some land so they can do their stuff, giving them a new life, off-world opportunities and all that kind of thing. But the Senate needs to approve it somehow.
I know. Well, this is where we once again come back to the confusion of the early republic. So a plebiscite is a measure that's passed in the plebeian assembly, and it's meant to be binding for all plebeians and eventually also all Roman citizens. However, This is something we know comes about much later. We don't really know if there was exactly such a thing at this moment, and certainly we can't be certain, obviously, who it would be applicable for. You know, would it have been the plebeians? Do the plebeians even exist? I mean, we come back to that question.
Yes, and this is where we have that sort of the issues with our source material, as always, where we have a position known as the Tribune of the Plebs, but it's not yet well established what distinguishes them out necessarily, besides being not the elite. And to what extent are there formal processes in place for the Tribune of the Plebs to sort of bring this group of people together or representatives thereof to make any kind of decision? We don't know if the Tribune of the Plebs has that kind of power at this time.
Yeah, exactly. So as it turns out, it's a bit of a moot point because Bolle ends up being recaptured the following year. The Aequians set up a colony there to make it stronger and obviously more resistant to the Romans, I suppose, coming along and taking it back. Yay. And so that's pretty much all I have officially for that year.
But may I jump in with some details about Lucius Decius, our Tribune of the Plebs?
You know what? You may, but only after my geographical detail.
Oh, are we going back to Vey for a quick minute?
We're going back for that question about the geography of this whole story. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the official account that comes from Livy. Subsequent scholars have pointed out that it seems unlikely that the Tiber would have flooded in the area of Vey. The flooding usually happens closer to Rome. So if there was flooding, presumably it would have been Roman farms that were being flooded, which makes this story of not wanting to go to war because of a flood a little confusing.
It's not that it would be impossible, I'm sure.
No.
But it would have to be quite a significant flood. I guess it just depends. I'm not good enough with water and my knowledge of flooding to be able to speculate further on that one.
Well, this is where you might be able to help me out. Because apparently, whilst the geography doesn't entirely make sense, at the same time, if we're just talking about flooding in general, rivers are obviously very important to communities. I mean, to be honest, they're still very important to this day, but we just, for a lot of people, because we live more urban lives, we perhaps are less aware of our dependence on water because it seems to just come effortlessly out of taps. And that's obviously not really the reality of the world that we live in, but nonetheless, I'm not going to get distracted by an environmentalism tangent. So rivers are obviously very important. People depend on them, obviously, as like a life-giving source. And floods are definitely often seen as prodigies. So they have this added religious element. And therefore, this might be the kind of thing that might have been recorded in the annals of that year, because it would have been something, obviously, that people would have been observing and considered important. And so what Ogilvy, who's the commentary that I'm looking at for this, has suggested is that maybe there was a record of a flood in this time, and later historians have come along and somehow twisted it into a motive as to why there wasn't a war in this year.
I mean, that sort of presupposes that they had a narrative about there being a war before they knew about the flood, which seems a bit odd as well. And I'm like, guys, I mean, you don't have to have a war every year.
Exactly.
Rome's
yes.
excellent at having domestic issues. But realistically, if we're thinking geographically as well, ancient Vey is now, it was about 8 kilometers from Rome,
right?
Ancient Rome.
Yeah.
In modern terms, Vey is part of Rome.
Yes.
Like that is,
how close
you're
they
still,
are. Yeah.
You're still very close to the city at that point. In terms of the river itself, these things would be very hard to judge now as well, because there's been a lot of work done on the Tiber to prevent it from flooding.
You sure?
Because it is a river that goes through a city, and it constantly flooding is an issue for people. So the Tiber is very much built up on all of its banks in order to prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
It would be, this is one of those moments where you want to go back in time, but like, what did it look like topographically?
Yeah.
These are the things that that you want to be able to sort of come to grips with, because it would give you a sense of the nature of the landscape and how it might have, people interacted with it and how nature might have taken its toll on the people around it with things like flooding, for instance.
Yes, I agree with what you said, because I thought the same thing. I'm like, well, sure, they could twist it into a motive, but they'd have to have known that there was a possibility of a war because there is no war. So why would they even say that? Why wouldn't they just say there was a flood?
wouldn't it just be easier to talk about a flood instead? I mean, like, there was a terrible flood, guys.
Exactly. We all love hearing stories about flood. Just ask the Christians.
It might come from a desire to continue to bolster this idea of Rome being in a constant state of, like, military alertness and activity, which is all about them gaining the skill set that will enable them to eventually dominate the entire Italian peninsula.
I can get on board with the idea that there would have been a record of a significant flood, because it would have been something in the natural world that might have been seen as some sort of, you know, some sort of sign.
A sign.
It's a sign.
Give me a sign.
I saw the sign and I wrote it down. but that's about all I have on that. I do have a little bit of detail about Decius as well, but I'm going to let you run with what you've got and see if mine is different.
All right, so Lucius Decius, what a man, but more importantly, what a name. Am I right?
That's where I was going, so take it away, Dr. G.
So things get tricky with this guy because he's involved in this idea of agrarian reform and trying to get things done and it not really working out. Which, for the reader of sources like Livy, is immediately, I think, going to put them in mind of a much later Decius, who was also a tribune of the plebs.
Indeed.
And this is Publius Decius Subulo, who was doing his business in around about 120 BCE, tribune of the plebs, and a huge supporter of the Gracchi. Who are infamous for their interest in agrarian reform.
I was going to say, the people that love land the most.
Indeed.
Or love land reform the most, I should say. Yeah.
You say agrarian, I say Gracchi. But there are some other Decius characters that sort of crop up in the Republic of Rome's history. I'm not sure that these are necessarily a launch point for anything to do with our particular Decius. But I'm just going to do a little bit of foreshadowing because I think it will be fun. So we've got a
foreshadowing.
We have a few Deciuses coming up, and one of them is Publius Decius Mus from around about 325 BCE.
What an odd name!
Yeah, so give us another century of the podcast, and we will get there. But he is most well known for sacrificing himself in battle. His son, Publius Decius Mus, so the first son, is also infamous for winning a battle for Rome through self-sacrifice.
I'm noticing a trend.
Also have the grandchild, Publius Decius Mus.
Oh, my God.
Who is also attributed to having won a battle through sacrificing himself.
How on earth did his family survive?
I don't think that line did, at least not very well.
No.
But these Decii seem to be outside of sort of like the, there doesn't seem to me to be a substantial connection between these guys and why you might mention a name like Decius for the Tribune of the Plebs. But we've got some interesting figures coming up in our history. But there does seem to be this weird sort of parallel with this Gracchan Decius, which I think is probably worth keeping in mind.
Yeah, look, I think you're right about that, because from my research, definitely there is suspicion about someone of this name popping up so early in Rome's history. We have had a few mentions of this name before in Dionysius, not in Livy. but it seems like, as you say, this is a name that becomes famous and important later on. And so in typical Roman historical tradition, they have retrojected them back into early Rome's past because they want to, you know, play up their significance and the continuity that's there and all of that kind of stuff. But certainly it seems dubious that there would have been anyone from this family in Rome earlier than the 4th century BCE. So yeah, it just doesn't seem to quite tally up. And apparently, this is a family that hail from southern Italy.
Yes. Mm. The Decii Mures, possibly thought to be from Campania originally. So moving up for Rome for a brand new life and then maybe just sacrificing themselves in battle all the time.
They just love it so much. They love it so much.
Let me fight for you, Rome. Let me die for you.
Indeed. And that's about all I've got for 415 BC, Dr. G. So are you ready to tackle 414?
Oh, so ready.
All right, let's do it. So, once again, 414 BCE, Dr. G, who were the magistrates? There are a lot of them.
Finally, I feel like I'm on firmer territory now. 414 was where I wanted to start. We have four military tribunes with consular power.
Mm-hmm.
Big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
They're all patrician.
Oh, yeah.
We have Gnaeus Cornelius Cossus.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing something here.
Lucius Valerius Potitus.
Mm-hmm.
Quintus Fabius Vibulanus.
Oh, there's a trend. There's a trend.
Publius Postumius Albinus Regulensis.
Does that mean he was as pale as me?
As white as snow. We have those four guys.
Yeah.
Now, reputedly, Postumius has some business with Bolle that might be coming up.
Mm-hmm.
That I suspect you will have the details of.
Oh, I have all the details.
I'm looking forward to those details because all I have is the barest sketch of what might have happened.
Well, you know, I'm just noticing though when I look at these names, once again, we've got some families that are really clinging on with their fingernails to power.
Yeah, and actually this was something that in the lieu of having like a strong narrative source, I do have some things to say about families and power in this period. So when we come to the end of the narrative aspect, let me know and I will give you some more details on that.
You'll know.
We also have a tribune of the plebs, a Marcus Sextius.
Oh, yeah. Bring it on.
It's time for a sexy.
What a man, what a man, what a mighty good man. He's a mighty, mighty good man.
Oh, sexy Sextius. He is here.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently we also have a quaestor, Publius Sextius.
Yeah, I'm not going to give him the song.
Maybe less sexy. So
Publius, it just, you know, it sounds a lot like pubic, which I suppose should make it more sexy, but somehow it doesn't.
Oh, ouch. So the thing I think to mention here is that how do names work? And actually we will be having an episode coming on names soon, so that space.
Yeah.
But we do have both a tribune of the plebs with the coming from the gens Sextius, and we also have a quaestor coming from the gens Sextius.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it would be more likely than not that the quaestor is a patrician from the patrician gens Sextius, and Marcus would be a plebeian.
Sure, yeah.
So I don't really have a resolution for that. I haven't solved that at all. I'm just mentioning it in passing.
Well, again, it sort of highlights what we've been talking about, though, about this patrician plebeian divide. How much does it really exist? How much are they, you know, imagining that it was so strong as it was? And obviously it's possible to have branches of the family, you know, where one line is patrician and one line isn't. So
definitely. And I think this is a moment where having a quaestor means it's probably worth touching on what's a quaestor at this point in time.
Indeed.
So there are two versions of quaestors to consider. There's the very ancient quaestores parachidii. They are brought together only for special occasions.
They are the Miss Marples of the ancient Roman world.
They are. They're very cute. They're little detectives. They get their magnifying glass out. They're like Pikachu. Detective Pikachu. They investigate capital offences. And these guys go back at least as far as the 12 tables. But they're sort of co-opted when needed. They might lead juries. They might be the head of a jury. And it largely seems to be unconnected to what is later famously the quaestor role, which is considered the first rung on the cursus honorum.
Yes. And they deal with financial matters a lot of the time, don't they?
Well, this is where the other part of the quaestorship comes into it. So essentially the Parakidii could do some of that sort of stuff, but it seems like these sort of roles do get split.
Right.
So the magisterial quaestors, the one that we become famously associated with the Cursus Honorum, are sort of suggested in later sources. And this is where Tacitus comes back into play.
Yeah.
Tacitus's annals, our only mention of this. So goodness knows, I mean, where he turned up this piece of information and whether we can believe it is just bonkers. But he suggests that quaestors existed in the sort of like the monetary sense, looking after finances and things like that, as far back as the kings. I'm not sure that any of us believe that necessarily, although somebody must have been in charge of the cash.
Well, yeah. I mean, God knows, I don't think the kings are doing it.
I mean, it would be weird if they were just bathing in their own money.
Like Scrooge McDuck.
I mean, conspicuous consumption is pretty important for elites in the ancient world, so maybe. Mm. But you might have wanted somebody for the mundane business of the day-to-day, and maybe you had a person for that. But we do have this idea, again, from Tacitus, that we have two quaestors elected each year from 447 BCE onwards.
Mm.
So that would suggest, even though we don't have any sort of record of them, that this magistracy has been in place for a good sort of 20, 30 years already.
Well, that's obviously the time period that we talked about with the sort of refounding of the Roman state after the second Decemvirate has its downfall.
They decided they needed somebody in charge of the treasury that was separate from the people holding power.
Yeah, smart move, you know. And then, of course, we had some issues where it was like, can patricians only hold it? Can plebeians hold it? We've had some back and forth about that in our sources, definitely. So there is some stuff that's coming through about them existing. But if we're looking at when they're written, of course, like Livy, Dionysius, Tacitus, they're all from that late Republic, early Empire time period.
Yeah, so we've got to be a little bit suspicious of what they might be telling us. So Tacitus has this idea of there being two quaestors from 447, and then Livy suggests that this was increased to four quaestors in 421, so very recently, and as far as we're at in our narrative in 414.
Because of all the paperwork, Dr. G.
There's just so much. Well, you've got wars on multiple fronts, and part of the role of the quaestor is administering the state treasury. So doing the things in the city, looking after the cash, maybe bathing in the money when nobody's looking. But also importantly, two things connected with the military, and that is looking after the war chest itself.
Yes.
So whatever excellent booty has been taken that might be in coin or valuable precious materials that is highly carryable, that will be something the quaestor looks after. And this might be why you have to have more than one quaestor, because if you've got more than one war going on, you've got more than one war chest.
Oh, and you also want someone watching the people with the money. You can't just have one guy looking after the money.
You're telling me they have to come in pairs, like the guys with the armored trucks and the vans and stuff coming to get the money out of the ATM machine?
110%.
They both have guns, so they can shoot each other if necessary.
It's just a recipe for corruption. If you've only got one guy, the Romans knew that. I know that.
The other key thing that they seem to be involved with, besides sitting on the war chest and having a good time there, is the actual logistics supplies of war itself.
Less fun.
Obviously, sitting on the money is one thing, but being able to spend it to get the supply lines happening is also very, very important. So the quaestor would have to be working very closely with the military commander in the field to make sure that things were going smoothly on the supply line front.
Absolutely.
In terms of what was needed. So it's actually a really important role.
It is.
And these are the sorts of things that we think quaestors might be doing around about this period in time.
Indeed. But who knows, as we've already said.
I offered plenty of doubt in that explanation,
yeah,
I feel.
Yeah. We always have that caveat. All right. Well, Dr. G, strap yourself in for a rollicking good time, because I have got some goss for you about this year.
Ooh.
As you highlighted, one of our military tribunes with consular power for this year is one Postumius. Now, this is a name that we have heard many a time before, and unfortunately, it's rarely in a great light. Like, they're not always like terrible people, particularly by Roman standards, but they're not you know, soft and cuddly. They're not going to be the spokespersons for fabric softener, if you know what I mean.
I hear you.
Yeah. So, Posthumius of this year is put in charge of the delayed campaign against the Aquians. According to Livy, Posthumius was, and I quote my translator, a wrong-headed man.
Oh, dear. That is unfortunate.
Yeah. So, starts off okay. He manages to gather an army, you know, get his forces together, go to Bolle, manages to beat the Aquians in some trifling engagements. I don't know whether this is the conflict where Livy is like, it's not worthy of description. It's all very confusing.
It's now being described, though, so surely this is different.
Oh, I feel like Livy's way of describing things just leaves me with more questions than answers. I need to probably actually, like, sit down and, like, storyboard this conflict, but whenever Livy does mention it, he makes it sound so unimportant that I don't know why I'd be bothered. But anyway, he does manage, because he is successful in, admittedly, fairly meh conflict, to get inside the city of Bolle. Now, Posthumius had initially said that the booty gained from this engagement would go to his soldier.
Okay. I mean, that sounds reasonable. I mean, that's very why nice. You fight.
Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. It is very nice. However, he does that classic thing that, to be honest, parents and teachers should never do. And that is, he's made this promise, and then once they're inside the city, he changes his mind. Follow through, Dr. G.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you never say something that you're not prepared to follow through with. That is my number one rule for both parenting and teaching.
Yeah, it's got to be realistic. There's got to be, the consequence has to be real, yeah. Regardless of whether it's positive or negative.
Clearly, we have to be given this detail because it would seem that it's fairly definite in the source material that the army became very upset with Posthumius and they need to find a reason as to why.
Was he revolting?
Livy records a couple of versions. So obviously the reason for them being upset is not set in stone. The fact that they were upset seems fairly definite.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, so Livy thinks that this is why the army was upset, because Posthumius obviously made them a promise. It's obviously a pretty important one because it's about getting that sweet, sweet cash. But there is another version where the army became upset with him because when they entered the city and started obviously like ravaging it, they didn't find that it was as wealthy as they had imagined. So they feel like
there's a disappointment.
Quite frankly, those are two very different stories. One of them, I feel, soldiers rightly upset. Other version, entitled much.
I mean, what do you expect? I mean, we all know the booty's been shifting around in the region for decades at this point.
Yeah. Anyway, the situation rapidly starts to deteriorate either way. It's not looking good. And then the other military tribunes send for Posthumius because there are some problems back in Rome. So let's segue now to back in Rome. This is where our tribune of the plebs comes in. One Marcus Sextius. Oh, yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing what he's done to receive this sexy epithet.
He has deserved absolutely nothing other than having something to do with the number 6, I would imagine. I don't know. I don't know. But either way, he's obviously a classic tribune of the plebs because he's trying to once again pass an agrarian law.
Well, good for him. I mean, that is the job of the tribune of the plebs at this point. The people need land. They need to be able to live their lives.
They do. So he is once again pushing for this idea that there should be colonists from Rome sent out to the city of Bolle, specifically because he thinks it should be given to the people who actually captured it. And I don't mean literally the soldiers, but obviously that group that they supposedly belong to.
Yeah, seems reasonable.
Unfortunately, when Posthumius hears about what's going on back in Rome, he made some snide comment. Basically, very aggressive and threatening to those who fought under him, which was something along the lines of, you'll fight for me and you'll like it and you'll shut the hell up.
Wow, okay, Posthumius. I think this is the wrong-headedness coming through.
Exactly. Now, this comment The plebeian assembly hear about it, and they are very upset. And to make matters worse, the comment is also reported back in the Senate. And they're also angry at him because they're like, oh my god, we're already dealing with a troublesome tribune. We really didn't need to add fuel to the fire here.
Guys, stop it.
Now, the tribune of the pleb, however, sees this as a chink in the patrician armor because he understands that clearly Postumius is very easy to bait. He's someone who's got that patrician arrogance and could easily be trapped into falling into an argument. And not only would he therefore probably damage his own rep, but probably the people that he represents. So I presume they mean the Senate and the patricians at large here. Marcus Sextius made sure to draw Postumius into this debate about the agrarian law more than any of the other military tribunes with consular power for this year. He's the one that he's like laser focused on.
Let's make him break.
Yeah. I mean, he's described as wrong-headed, so maybe he's also really easy to spot. Marcus Sextius really seizes upon the comment. He's like, Postumius, how dare you, threatening your own soldiers? Threatening to punish them like they are mere slaves? And here you are holding such a high office, you know, you're entrusted with this amazing position, and yet you so look down upon the men that have actually fought and given their lives, given their blood to capture this territory, and yet you don't even see them as worthy. And of course, and this is a great move rhetorically, he's like, why do people like this keep getting elected as military tribunes? Why? Why are we electing patricians instead of plebeians? They're clearly it's such like, gigantic you know, guys, douchebags.
We just keep putting them into power. You know, we got to eat the rich. Eat.
I know. Now, of course, this comment has also got back to the army who, I mean, they were angry before for some reason. Now they're really, really angry.
Like, wait a minute, this guy.
Exactly. This is where our quaestor comes into the situation.
Uh-oh.
Our other man, Publius.
Our man on the ground, Publius Sextius.
Well, this is the thing. There's a bit of confusion about whether it's Sextius or Sestius. I know. Just to really throw a spanner into the works.
Yeah. Let me update my notes.
No. I mean, there is genuine confusion. Like, we don't really know. I'm going to say Sestius just to keep him
distinct.
Separate.
Yeah, good plan.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Or maybe I'll just call him Publius. So Publius caught wind of the fact that there's clearly some mutinous feeling happening for these soldiers who were technically under the command of Postumius. And he decides, I know what the answer to this is. Violence. The threat of violence has got them really riled up. So I'm going to use actual violence to deal with this situation.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, exactly.
Our poor summer quaestor.
So what ends up happening is he uses a lictor, and these are the guys that obviously follow magistrates around with the fasces and whatnot.
Yeah, our quaestor should have about 2 maximum.
Well, he's using one of them to arrest a brawling soldier. Now, this leads to more violence. I mean, it's a lesson here, right? Violence just begets more violence. And a disturbance breaks out. And our quaestor is struck by a stone in the fray. And he runs away before he gets hurt even worse. I mean, I presume that by this stage, he's probably terrified that he's going to be, like, lynched or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the man who had thrown the stone at our quaestor, Publius, shouts out that Publius had been treated as Postumius had intended to treat the soldiers. So it's like poetic justice.
Mm-mm.
He's like, this is clearly what Postumius wanted to do to us, and now you guys are getting some of your own medicine.
Goodness me.
So Postumius is summoned back to this army because he clearly has to address the situation.
You got
to
get your troops under control, man. They just threw a rock at your quaestor.
He's been hit in the head. It's not good. Now, Postumius continues to be a wrong-headed man because he makes the situation even worse again.
Oh, no.
By dealing with it with really harsh interrogation and brutal punishment.
Good-o. Does Livy go into any detail of what those might be?
Yes, he does, actually. His anger gets really out of control. Some men are executed. Mm. I mean, there's really no higher punishment than that.
Yeah.
And I can kind of understand why, not in the sense that I think it's justified, but in a Roman mindset, if they are actually like mutinous soldiers, well, you do tend to see pretty extreme punishments to deal with that kind of stuff in ancient Rome.
Yeah, and military discipline historically has sort of followed these kinds of lines, because if you can't follow the orders of your superiors, then it creates a huge issue for the safety of everybody.
Yes, exactly. These executions were apparently carried out using a hurdle. Now, my only knowledge of a hurdle is the thing that you would jump over.
I was going to say, I'm like, are we talking like the 100-meter hurdles? Because I'm like, I suppose anything that's heavy, you could slap at somebody, but I suspect that this is not what is being referred to.
No, because what Livy says is that the people who are being executed, who I presume are like the ringleaders, you know, maybe the guy who threw the stone, he would be the obvious target.
We're calling him Rocky.
Yeah, Rocky One. So Rocky One cried out during his execution, and this ends up attracting the attention of a crowd of people. It would seem that a hurdle might be something which allows you to be crushed to death. So they put really heavy weights and stones on top of you until you are crushed.
Jeez, that is a terrible way to die.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is out of control. He really is wrong-headed.
Yeah, Postumius, what were you thinking? Wrong things all the time.
I know. So obviously a crowd is gathering around because there's noise coming from the place of executions. Mm. So Postumius then rushes over from his tribunal because he doesn't want anyone to try and interfere with the executions and to try and stop them and feel sorry for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Lictors and centurions start lashing out at the crowd, and they're trying to push them back so that they can't interfere with the punishments that are going on. And of course, does the crowd take this well? You better believe they don't. And essentially what ends up happening in all of this, in this violent melee, is that Postumius is stoned to death.
Wow. Okay. So
from his soldiers, not just a random crowd.
Yeah. It becomes full circle, essentially.
It's like one stone was thrown, but it's led to a whole volley. So obviously this is a huge deal because one of the leading magistrates of the state has just been killed by his own army whilst trying to administer justice and discipline.
Wow. Okay. Look, these details are really interesting.
I know.
I have a slightly different version of events, which I'm not going to suggest in any way would be superior to what you've just told me, because it comes from Dio Cassius.
Ooh, okay. So for our listeners, Dio Cassius is writing hundreds of years after Livy and Dionysius, so really, really late.
Really late. And he also writes a history of Rome from the foundation of the city, but he's starting from a much later point in Rome's history.
Indeed, so he is.
His ability to get hold of material is even more challenging. But he does talk about this. And it comes under a heading. It comes from a fragment with a heading, "Democracy consists not in all winning absolutely the same prizes, but in every man obtaining his deserts."
Ah.
Oh.
That kind of sounds like he's on the side of the crowd.
So he tells us that Postumius has conquered the Aquae. Mm-hmm. And he's captured Bolle.
Yes.
But the soldiers had it turned over to them for pillage, but they weren't awarded a share of the plunder when they requested it. So they did the job that Postumius is leading. They're like, we need to pillage this place. We need to get the loot. And once the loot has all been collected, Postumius rounds it all up and places it with the quaestor. And the troops are like, what about our booty? Where's our share of the booty? Because usually it comes in and then it gets redistributed. It's not just like a free-for-all and you pick up whatever piece that you pick up and it's yours. The idea is it's done as a collective and then it's redistributed out. So if you did really well that day in the pillaging on the battlefield or whatever, the commander would give you maybe a bigger portion of the booty, a nicer piece if you like.
Yeah.
When that didn't happen, when that request was denied, this is when things become really unhinged for this army.
Okay.
And they surround the quaestor, so because they have a particular spot where, and obviously they're sitting on all of the booty, and then they kill the quaestor, just like that.
Right.
And then when Postumius reprimands them and is like, excuse me, guys, you can't just kill the quaestor. I know we
know.
Now
he's going to do the paperwork.
No is a no. Why aren't you listening? And he starts to try to sort of do an investigation to try and figure out, like, you know, who's the ringleaders in this, got to round them up, bring them to justice. The army turn on him and kill him as well.
Right. So it's a bit more dramatic and there's a little less justification.
Well, I don't know if there's less justification. I think the idea of being denied a portion of the booty is actually a hugely significant move from Postumius, because this is not something that we've really come across before, where a commander says, under no circumstances are you getting a share of this booty.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like my version where he said they could have it and then changed his mind, I mean, come on.
That does make him more wrongheaded, that's true.
I could get quite murderous if someone said I could have a piece of cake and then said no.
Fair enough.
it's a dangerous move.
It is a dangerous move. And regardless of how this came about, so we're not really quite sure of the technicalities on this, what we're seeing is that there is a disciplinary sort of breakdown within the armed forces.
Definitely.
That is the result of a style of leadership.
For sure, yeah.
So Rome is starting to build out an understanding of what is possible to get soldiers to do and to agree to, and where the line is for what you cannot ask a soldier to do.
Yeah.
At the risk of your own life as a commander or one of the officers.
All right. What happens in my account next is that naturally, back in Rome, people hear about the fact that Postumius was, stoned to death. And the military tribunes with consular power obviously want a senatorial inquiry into the death because this is super unusual. However, the tribunes of the plebs step in and use their veto power to stop an inquiry from going forward.
Wow.
I know.
Okay, so Marcus Sextius getting in there.
He is. And now, of course, we don't know if the tribunes really did have veto power at this point in time, but let's run with it. Now the Senate are really worried because obviously the men under Postumius's command were really riled up to go through with this. And the people back in Rome are really riled up because of this comment Postumius made. I mean, never before have six Australians may break your bones, but words can really hurt you. It's so true for everybody involved. And they're really concerned and they are worried that if they go ahead and have elections for military tribunes with consular power, that this might be the year where Publian finally gets elected because the people are just so angry.
I'm so pissed off. I'm going to run for government.
Exactly. I'm going to be the change I want to see in the world. And they might want a plebeian in that office because they could then stop any inquisition from going forward. So that would be the idea, I guess, that the tribunes have vetoed it and their way of making sure that it couldn't come up in the following year was by getting one of their own on the inside, you know. They pushed really hard for consular elections. They wanted to have consuls so that it had to be patricians, and then obviously they want to have their inquiry, right? The tribunes of the plebs naturally see through this. And they're not going to let it happen. And so once again, we find ourselves in a standoff between the Senate and the Tribune of the Plebs. And we're in an interregnum, basically. Yeah, which is this weird thing, this weird hangover from the regal period.
Well, whenever you can't find a way to get a magistracy up and happening using the appropriate time frame and the appropriate ritual circumstances, then you have to have this interim official step in. So they're still called the interrex, even though they're largely responsible for the chief magistrates, the consulship.
Anyway, eventually the Senate end up prevailing. So spoiler alert, there's going to be consuls in the next year.
keep that one under my hat.
I know, it's pretty crazy. But that is where the story really wraps up.
Interesting.
I know. So it's again, it is another episode that kind of ties into the conflict of the orders, but it also has a lot more to it than that, I think, because of the way that, you know, the army is involved and also the reputation of one particular family. And if I may, Dr. G, I'd like to say a little bit about the Postumii.
Please do.
The Postumii have not had a great run in our history so far. They're always coming across as the harshest of harsh Romans. I mean, they're the Brillo pads of the Roman world.
They are the elite of the elite.
They're just getting into trouble a lot recently. So we had the really severe dictator not that long ago, who was a Postumii, who killed his own son for his conduct during a battle that he was in charge of. So this guy wasn't wrong-headed per se, but he was held up obviously as being particularly severe because he would kill his own son as a punishment. Then, of course, we also had a military tribune with consular power in the mid-420s who was terrible in his conduct of battle against Vey and ended up being hauled over the coals for that. So he went up in court, they wanted to fine him, he was that bad. And then, of course, we also had, lest we forget, the Vestal Virgin Postumia, who's obviously from this family, who was very nearly buried alive not long ago.
It's not her fault. I don't think you can throw her in with all of them.
No.
But it might have been a move to get back at their family, for sure.
Exactly. This is the question that we can pose. Obviously, we can't answer it. But is it possible that in this very tumultuous period, where we're looking at sort of from the second decemvirate, really almost down to the close of this century, there's a lot of issues, obviously, with Rome. That's why we're seeing all these stories about the conflict of the orders. Even though the conflict of the orders might not be a real thing, it's quite clear that Rome is going through some teething problems. And if we look at this as being part of what you and I have talked about, as maybe this period is actually more about warlords and strongmen and alliances, you know, families, very mafia-like, if you will, it's possible that the Postumii are on the outs. They're not doing well in these, you know, in this these feuds, perhaps, between families. And we can, of course, see that there are links between the Postumii and other families. So we've seen some familiar links between them and the Sempronii and the Quinctii and that sort of thing. But it seems like maybe these bonds are being really tested by what is happening at this moment.
Yeah, you got enough bad eggs. You're going to have to throw the whole family away, as it were. So yeah. I think this ties in really nicely to this pattern of patrician families that I've been looking into. So I thought...
Wait, I have one more detail. Sorry. I have one more detail.
Hold on. And I was sorry. I've got so much to say.
I'm sorry. Just one more detail, and I promise it's all yours. So just another interesting thing to note. And again, not that I'm saying this wasn't a real guy who was really a douchebag, but there is an interesting parallel with a much later story about Postumius Albinus, who was killed by sailors under his command in 89 BCE during the siege of Pompeii during the Social Wars. So that's also just an interesting thing to note. I mean, again, doesn't mean that this guy wasn't stoned to death, or it doesn't mean he didn't exist or whatever. But once again, we're seeing those interesting trends or those interesting connections, maybe foreshadowing. Who knows? From that later republic, which is more obviously better documented, particularly for the people who are writing and our main sources.
Yeah, for sure. A bit in the same way that we see those potential parallels with Decius from the previous year.
Yeah, exactly.
They've got some closer stories and they're interested in building out a sort of a moral pattern related to families, which is very much in this Roman way of thinking that, you know, your family determines something about your character.
Exactly. And
certainly that's true, but it doesn't bode well for the Postumii as a particular gens right now because they're coming across badly.
I know. And with that being said, I will now hand over to you and you can tell me everything you want about the Postumii.
Oh, look, it's some basic maths, but what I was interested in, because we're seeing a lot of names crop up a lot, and yes. I was like, well, actually, is that a feeling for me or is this a pattern in the evidence? And sure. I was like, it's time to do some spreadsheeting.
Ooh.
And so the question I asked myself, because I didn't want to go back to right to the beginning of the Republic because I just I'm not in the mood for that right now. But I was like, who has dominated the politics in the last 20 years from a family perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Who has really come across as, like, you know, the top families to watch out for? So in my examination of, like, you know, all of the magistrates that we've looked at so far, and I just focused on the patricians, so I left the Tribune of the Plebs to one side for now, there were 28 distinct genses that came up in that. So there's a lot of family competition going on.
For sure.
Definitely more families than we've got years that we've studied. So I'm looking at 434 down to 414.
Okay.
The top family in terms of position holding is the Quintii gens.
No surprises there.
I don't think that would come as a surprise because that the branch of the Cincinnatus comes out of that gens, for instance.
Yes, exactly.
And they hold 4 consulships, 5 military tribunes, and they also have a military legate chucked in there. But even
I am very impressed by your mathematical dedication, by the way.
I don't know. I made a spreadsheet and then I did some at the end. It was very impressive. That is about the extent of my mathematical skill. So even if you discount the 1 military legate, because that's, you know, not a hugely illustrious position, big deal. They still have 9, which still puts them ahead. So 4 consulships, 5 military tribunates. They're followed swiftly by the Papyrii gens.
Yes.
Who have 2 consuls, 3 military tribunes with consular power, 2 censors, and 1 interrects.
Ooh,
fancy
nice.
Pants time for them.
I know.
And then we get into a 3-way tie. So things are not straight and smooth at the top. It is highly competitive, even in this very early period, according to the records that we have.
Mm-hmm.
The 3-way tie for 3rd position, so they're all getting the bronze medal, are the Servilii, the Postumii, and the Fabii.
Yes.
So the fabulous Fabians, they're in there. Each of these genses holds 7 positions of elite power across those 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, whether the Postumii can continue up with this trend may very well depend on what kind of characters they produce in the next generation.
I know. They better watch out for those wrong heads.
I know. I mean,
get their heads screwed on straight. You know what I'm saying?
The wrong-headedness of it all.
Yeah, I know.
So the only other thing I have to mention is things like, you know, Diodorus Siculus getting all of the names kind of wrong for this year. Very cute. He's trying his best. He got all the kind of the gens names right and all of the praenomens wrong as far as we can tell. And that is the end of 414 BCE as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'm very impressed by your spreadsheeting because I avoid Excel like the plague.
Fair enough, fair enough. I wouldn't say I go to it to have a good time, but I was like, you know what? I need to put this in a different way so my mind can sort of wrap around the information differently. And I think it helped. I think it helped.
Yeah, look, and it does confirm, you know, because of the way that we do this, where we're going year by year, like the Romans themselves would have done, sometimes you kind of have a very hazy feeling of like, look, that name sounds familiar, but I can't really remember how many times I've really said it in the past year. You know,
exactly.
Maybe I've said it every episode. You certainly know that certain names are coming up more than others.
For sure.
It's good to have it all confirmed. Now, the final interesting detail I'm going to add, because we did just note that obviously we've got this like weird interregnum period thing when we've got a standoff between the plebeians and the Senate. It's possible that what we're seeing with the interregnum is maybe not necessarily when there is a standoff between patricians and plebeians, but potentially it's something that comes up when we're switching from military tribunes to consuls or back the other way.
Yeah, potentially. And I could see how this might have more of effect for the consulship than it would for military tribunes with consular power.
Yeah.
Because they might be considered lesser just in general.
Sure.
If indeed they existed at all.
Who knows? I mean, this is the thing. Did an interregnum even happen? I don't know.
I like to think so. I'd more well believe that because the Romans do like this kind of thing of like, you know, it's got to be done the right way. So the interrex is basically a ritual and legislative functionary to ensure that things happen in the right way in the periods where things are not currently happening the way that they're supposed to.
Indeed, indeed. All right, Dr. G, well, I think that means it's time for the partial pick.
Well, there's 50 golden eagles up for grabs. They can win up to 10 eagles in each of the five categories.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see how Rome goes.
Indeed. All right. What's our first category, Dr. G?
Military clout.
Yes. Well, I mean, technically, militarily, they actually do pretty well. I mean, it's not obviously a major thing. Livy is clearly unimpressed.
Doesn't want to describe it at all.
Well, so unimpressed that I'm really confused about what I'm talking about. Like, is this the thing that he didn't want to describe? Did that happen earlier? I don't know. But it's obviously not the battle itself that's impressive. But nonetheless, they win Bolle for a short time anyway.
They do. And all of the other wars got cancelled. So that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I'd probably give them, I don't know, like maybe a 4.
Yeah, because it doesn't work out great afterwards. And it is related to the warfare. So
it is related to that. But in terms of them actually conquering something, they have.
They've done well. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's a 4.
All right. Our second category is diplomacy. I don't know. I don't know. I think that's a 0. Diplomacy? No.
Externally, where there's war, I don't think there can be much diplomacy, so that's a 0. And on the home front, certainly everyone's at each other's throats.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That's no eagles right there.
Okay.
Expansion.
Well, yes, they do add Bolle to their empire for a short time at least.
They haven't lost it yet, so I suppose we can give them 1 point for that. It's very close to home.
It is, but you know what? It's been a long time. Well, no, actually, you know what? It hasn't been that long. We had Libici recently, but it's been a long time before Libici came along, and now Bolle, which is right next door. I feel like we have to give them at least a 3.
I'll negotiate you to 2.
Everyone's going to call you the new Postumii because you're being way harsh.
Oh, my God.
But fine, too.
You know, I just, you know, when they do something good, I want to give them a reward. And I feel like, you know, it's next door. And you're like, you didn't really have to try that hard, did you?
Yeah, well, yeah, but like that's going to be the case for a really long time. Technically, everything's next door. The more that they keep expanding, everything's going to be next door.
And thus, I will continue to be wrong-headed.
You know what? They're going to conquer, like, I don't know, Dacia. And you're going to be like, whatever. The border is right there.
I mean, you were literally next door when you started.
You were
Big
right
deal.
There. I mean, like, you were just like, you were right there. You were like camped there. I mean, you had like a stone encampment, whatever.
Guys. All right. Virtus. Was there expressions of manliness going on?
Well, I mean, I think Postumius is pretty harsh. Yeah.
Postumius would think so, but that doesn't really work out for him, so...
No, I don't think we can count it as weird to us, as much as douchebaggery.
Fair enough. Okay, so that's a 0, I believe, as well.
It is.
And finally, the citizen score. Was this a good time to be a Roman citizen?
Oh, no. I mean, they are...
I didn't even get a piece of booty. Oh, my God.
Yeah, not only that, but they're obviously also really upset by feeling undervalued
Fair
by
enough.
The people higher up in their society. I mean, there is no one higher than a military tribune with consular power, you know, at the time that they hold office. So, yeah, they're not feeling good. And it's obviously a pretty terrible time to be a citizen, I think, especially because if a war is going on, as we know, obviously, that means that people are also serving away from their families, risking their lives.
Indeed. This is it's a big ask. Well, how many golden eagles did they get? I never do the maths on this. So.
Appropriately, in a year which we have a tribune named Sextius, we end up with 6. Golden Eagle.
Wow, 6. Okay. Look, that sounds pretty good, really, given how Rome's been trending lately.
Well, 6 out of 50 is not great, but I guess that's what you get for stoning your commander to death.
Oofed.
And for the commander to crush people to death under really, really heavy stone.
Yeah, not great. Not ideal at all.
It is not. It is not.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure to discuss the years 415 and 414 with you, Dr. Rad.
I know. I'm looking forward to discussing 413 because, I mean, I feel like that's got to be an unlucky year just from the sound of it.
We will soon find out.
Who knows? Maybe consuls will be being murdered in the street.
Stay tuned for our next episode.
Indeed. Before Dr. G and I leave you, we'd just like to remind you that we are going to be speaking at the Intelligent Speech Conference this year. So please head on over to the Intelligent Speech website. And if you use the code PEICE, you will be able to get a discount off your ticket and they'll know the Partial Historian sent you. It's coming up very soon in November, so you'll probably want to register soon. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Partial Historians. You can find our sources, sound credits, and an automated transcript in our show notes. Our music is by Bettina Joy de Guzman. You too can support our show and help us to produce more excellent content about the ancient world by becoming a Patreon. In return, you receive exclusive early access to our special episodes and some occasional bonus content as well. Today we'd like to give a special shout out to Dendrio and Azra, who became Patreons back in September 2022. So if our math is correct, since we are releasing this episode in September 2023, that makes it our 1 year anniversary. You can also support us by buying us a coffee on Ko-fi. However, if you aren't feeling particularly patrician these days, please just tell someone about the show or give us a 5-star review. That goes for our book as well. If you enjoyed Rex, the Seven Kings of Rome, please make sure you leave a review on Amazon or Gumroad. Until next time, we are yours in ancient Rome.